And stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations covering legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am Andre Hakes, your host. My guest today is Ann Coughlin. Ann, how you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Ann is a professor at UVA School of Law. Tell us a little bit about your background and about kind of what areas you focus on.
Well, my primary interests in teaching and scholarship are criminal law, criminal procedure, and feminist theory, the law of sex discrimination, if you will. And when I was in private practice, I worked for a brief period of time as a criminal defense lawyer. So I tend to approach criminal justice questions with a fairly complicated perspective, if you will, both thinking about how the law should be as an academic and a scholar, but also with a strong set of concerns about criminal defendants.
I imagine that creates some conflict in terms of, you know, how you view different issues. I would say that while I'm not a feminist jurisprudence kind of scholar, as a woman, as a lesbian in 2016, and a fairly strong liberal, and a criminal defense attorney, I often find that there are some, I feel conflicted about some of the issues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These issues for me become absolutely excruciating because there will be instances, and I assume we're going to be talking about them soon, where I believe that the criminal law needs to be reformed in ways that are more expansive, in ways that protect women against violence primarily by men, that eliminate the sexual double standard. So I want to expand criminal law definitions in order to help females, women. On the other hand, by doing that, we put criminal defendants at risk in a culture that is, I believe, too quick to criminalize and punish harshly. So it's a really big conflict for me.
Wow, I wonder if we'll fight or if we'll agree about everything. We'll find out.
I hope we do some of both.
Me too.
I hope we do some of both.
Me too. So I want to start with the concept of intent to defile. I understand that you have some thoughts about the Hannah Graham case and the idea of abduction with intent to defile from a sort of a theoretical perspective.
Correct. And I'm going to be quick to say I think it's much more than theoretical, so we've already going to cross swords. But in any event, I've been studying criminal law for years, and I've focused a lot of my research on domestic violence and sexual assault and rape. So this is a place that I am have devoted a lot of time and attention, expertise, I'll say. And so when Jesse Matthew was arrested in connection with the disappearance of Hannah Graham, the crime for which he was initially charged is called abduction with intent to defile. And that crime is set out in the Virginia Penal Code. That is the crime. So when the arrest took place, I'm so used to this archaic language, I'm going to make the case that it's archaic, that it didn't bother me a whole lot, either as a feminist scholar or a human being in Charlottesville. But a number of my friends came up and said, basically, what's up with this intent to defile language? What exactly is the crime for which he's being charged? Mm-hmm. And I told them, well, you know, really what it is abduction with intent to rape.
Or to sexually assault. Perhaps.
And the question then become, well, why are we using this word defile? Mm-hmm. So then it struck me really hard that we need to examine our criminal statutes, our Virginia law of sexual assault particularly, because you see in that phrase intent to defile more than just the remnants of archaic ways of thinking about rape and about what the injury of rape is. So our criminal law in Virginia is inherited from the old common law crimes, which themselves, of course, were developed centuries ago in England, and then we received them in the colonies. And at that time, the notion was, rape is a crime that defiles the woman. It makes her dirty. It deprives her of her chastity. It makes her unmarriageable. So that's the nature of the crime, the nature of the injury of the crime. And that's not the way I will submit that we do or should be thinking about the injury of rape today.
And I don't think it is the way we think about the injury of rape today, but I think that it is a hand-me-down from a historical perspective. I understand what you're saying. Defile, how can you defile someone, right? Do you just mean, what you really mean is sexually assault that person. But defile implies some fundamental change in their character.
Yeah, and so the notion was, again, at that time, in the according to the ways of thinking that create a crime, intent to defile, the idea is that women's honor, their virtue, lay in a certain kind of purity, a certain kind of cleanliness, if you will, that ends up being defiled and tainted by sex. And so, I guess I immediately want to say to you, I hear what you say, that's not the way we think about the crime anymore, but you do have to step back and ask yourself, well, why are women so reluctant to step up and report a rape? In part, it's because of these old ways of thinking. There's something dirty, there's something shameful about coming forward and reporting I've been raped, as opposed to coming forward and reporting I've been robbed, or reporting that I've been assaulted in some other way.
Because we might be internalizing the idea that we are defiled by having been a victim of a rape.
Correct. Or maybe the woman herself hasn't internalized it, but she fears that prosecutors and police officers will be thinking about that, that they'll be questioning her about her sex and her sexuality. And she may not feel that she's defiled, but she just doesn't feel like having a conversation with law enforcement officers who are enforcing a law that rests on the idea, this has defiled you.
Ah, I see. It seems I'm remembering that there's a code section somewhere in the Virginia Code that talks about, I think it makes it a crime to impugn the chaste character, the character of a chaste woman.
Correct.
You know, but if the woman's not chaste, then you can impugn their character all you want.
That's right. And again, I have to keep hitting this point home. The way of thinking was chastity was your honor.
Right.
So you had a character if you were chaste. If not, you are unworthy, right? You don't have a good any reputation.
I'm thinking about that. Do you know the Jethro Tull song, Velvet Green?
I do.
Do you know there's a line in that song about, you know, there lies your reputation, all that you're worth?
This is right.
That's exactly the concept you're talking about.
Exactly right. And again, I just want to emphasize, it's in my mind, it goes without saying, but coming out of the common law and up until quite recently, rape was a crime that could be committed only against women. So it was only women who were defiled by having sex. It was only women whose honor lay in their chastity. And so it's a really, you know, a very potent, powerful sexual double standard for women.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I guess when I said that's not how we think of it, you know, maybe the question is who's the we, but that's not how I think of it.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and then the other point that I want to develop here and actually talk a little bit about my agenda to try to persuade the General Assembly that it's time to revise some of our statutes. Certainly we want to change that label, abduction with intent to commit sexual assault, abduction with intent to commit rape. But the other point is that this old notion that rape is a crime that defiles the woman, that somehow pollutes her character and makes her an unworthy person going forward, we see those notions imprinted on the elements of the crime of rape and sexual assault and even sexual battery in Virginia. So
tell me what the elements are that you're referring to.
The specific elements that I have in mind are force, threat, and intimidation. So a sexual assault or a sexual battery occurs when there's either sexual intercourse or some kind of sexual touching. Again, non-consensual. It's got to be proved up to be non-consensual. But it also has to be proved that the non-consensual sex or the non-consensual touching occurred by force, threat, or intimidation. Mm-hmm. So we don't punish.
Or ruse, in some cases.
Well, that's the sexual battery statute. And if you want to talk about the origins of that, I can describe that story for you.
I do.
Good.
but not yet. Finish your
good,
thought.
Good. So my point is simply that we don't punish a perpetrator who has sex with another person who's not consenting, unless we also show that that perpetrator used force, used a threat, did something to intimidate, or in some cases used a ruse. And again, this suggests that we don't honor.
Well, we do.
No means no.
We do, because we have a statute that also says if the person is unable to express consent or non-consent, then that's also criminal.
That's right, but I'm thinking about cases where the party is able to express consent or non-consent. So if you have a person who is thoroughly capable of saying no, and he or she says no, and the perpetrator proceeds in the face of that no, it's going to be a crime only if there's force, threat, or intimidation.
Well, how do you proceed in the face of no without there being
there are cases.
I mean, the amount of force that's required is I touched you.
Well, not in the rape area, because in the rape area, the notion is that we're looking for some kind of force above and beyond the normal physical activity that we associate with sex.
Are you saying you think under the current criminal rape laws, you could have a case in which someone testifies and the jury or the judge believes that the person said no, and they then were had sex with, but there wasn't sufficient force?
I think that that's possible. Yep.
How is that possible?
I do, because the way in which the cases come down, and I'm pointing to cases, they're primarily from other states. We don't try that many rape cases in Virginia, so I'm not sure what the reaction would be here, but there is precedent in other states and over this exact point that says, notwithstanding the fact that the person said no, mm-hmm. that's not enough, that you need something above and beyond the ordinary physical activity that's associated with sex, with intercourse.
I don't think that's the case in Virginia. I think that there's, I mean, I've never seen an opinion that said that. And it as a criminal defense attorney, if I saw a case where I had those facts, I would not think to myself, oh, this will be a viable defense.
But that's an issue. That's a question under our statute.
Right.
And clearly, when women are deciding whether they want to report and go to the police, they and the police themselves are evaluating the case. Mm-hmm. They're being directed by the statute potentially to look for more. And then, of course, there are cases where the victim doesn't say no. You have a frozen fright response, mm-hmm. right? And again, we have to look for something above and beyond. We have to look for something forceful, something intimidating, something coercive in the environment.
Right.
So what I would hope we could move towards is a situation where we have a lesser included offense that doesn't require force, threat, or intimidation, but simply makes it a crime to have sex that is non-consensual, period, full stop.
Okay, so let's talk about what that means. What consent, we're talking about someone else's consent. We're talking, in your traditional rape scenario, male on female, we're talking about the woman's consent. But if the woman doesn't express consent or non-consent, how can we convict someone of a crime?
Well, if the burden of proof is going to be on the prosecutor to show that the sex was without consent, right? Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, it's going to be quite tricky to do in cases where the person doesn't say anything. But I take it that's the question about that we have to evaluate in these cases is if a person steps up and says, I didn't want to do this, mm-hmm. right? I didn't consent. We then have to ask, well, would a reasonable person in the position of the alleged perpetrator, what would that person have thought? So it does require a lot of really careful evaluation of the facts and circumstances. And it's really, really tough.
I think that at this point in time, it's the appropriate time for me to say that you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. And my guest this morning is Ann Coughlin, who's a law professor over at UVA. All right, but I would submit that a criminal sanction is the heaviest hand that our government has. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to brand someone for life and potentially take away their liberty, perhaps for many years, the rest of their life, perhaps nothing, but the possibility exists. And so we have to view criminality in a particularly coercive lens and be careful. And I would submit that in that system, we're not, you know, to say you are or are not guilty of a crime based on what is unexpressed in another person's head is not an appropriate use of the criminal justice system.
So I guess I'm going to say to you that there's no doubt that it's going to be complicated and it's going to be difficult. But why would a person who wants to have sex with another assume that it's okay for them to go forward when there is no expression by the other person? And I agree with you that the cases are going to be really, really tough. But that's what. Why should we punish a perpetrator based on the fact that the other person didn't express anything? And what I would say is, let's sort of flip the question and say, why is it reasonable for a person to go ahead and think they can have sex with someone who hasn't expressed themselves in any way, shape, or form? Now, again, it's hard to imagine what those cases look like, because usually people are expressing themselves verbally and through physical cues. So I want to be clear, our expression is not just yes, no, maybe in terms of verbal, but it's the way in which body language. But that's the question that I want to ask, is why is it appropriate for, and again, for someone to think, yo, I can go ahead and have sex with this person even though they haven't said or done anything that suggests that they agree?
I would agree with you that it is completely inappropriate.
Okay.
It is not reasonable. It is not any of those things.
Right.
But I would submit that when you're talking about crimes and the definition of a crime, it is a dangerous path to go down to cut that fine balance in favor of, or rather against, a criminal defendant. I think that if you are going to criminalize this, I'm not talking about, you know, some civil sanction. I'm talking about, you know, you're going to go to prison. I think it is appropriate to require, just in our justice system, in which beyond a reasonable doubt is an issue, and in which we have a presumption of innocence, particularly relying on the presumption of innocence, I would say that it is in that 51% case about whether or not there's consent was expressed. In a case in which nothing is expressed, I would submit that it is not appropriate to have it be a crime.
So I think what I hear you saying, though, is something here about mental state and mens rea, and what it is reasonable for people to believe in that context. And I guess you and I... Well, I guess I would ask you, if the defendant knows or is well aware of a risk that this person isn't consenting, if this person knows or is well aware of a risk that their failure to say or do anything means, whoa, they're not consenting, I take it you would say would you say that that's a different case?
So let me rephrase the question and make sure I understand the question. You're saying if you have a situation in which the defendant chooses to have sex with someone and actually knows, although the person hasn't said so, because I think actually knows and understands there's a risk of is different.
It is.
If the person actually knows that that person does not consent, then, yeah, I think you have non-consent. You have actual knowledge. It is the actual knowledge that matters.
Right.
But I think that the problem is, of course, how can they actually know?
No.
And I think the risk... possibility issue is back to sort of where I was before, which is you can't make it a crime. If you can prove actual knowledge, then you have every right to criminalize it.
Great. Well, my rejoinder, though, quickly to you is that there's so many instances in the criminal law where we do not require actual knowledge. We don't talk. The mental state that's required doesn't require proof that the defendant knows that what he's doing is in fact wrong or knows the facts on which he's acting, it's sufficient that a reasonable person would know. And so that's what I'm trying to ask you again here. That's why I started where I started. We punish people based on what we would call a gross negligence, a failure to abide by community norms. And again, what I'm wondering is why would the reasonable person think I can go ahead and have sex with someone who has not expressed in any way, shape, or form that they're consenting? And again, I want to set aside the cases where people have a long-standing relationship, because this example will constantly be thrown at me. What about people who are,
sure,
are intimate partners?
Right.
And there I immediately say, well, there's something in the context that might well, and in fact probably does suggest, this is the way we proceed, or it's reasonable for me to carry on. But if there's nothing in the context, why is it reasonable for one person to think it's okay for me to go and have sex? Do we do that with money? Like if someone says, just walks up and grabs your wallet and then says, well, her body language suggested that she want, you know, or she didn't say no. I mean, so you've got to really think about there. I take it we would go, no, that's unreasonable. The analogy might not be a good one. Sex and money, we have different social norms about the sharing of those assets, if you will. But that's all I'm trying to push on is, and to be honest with you, I'm more interested in having the conversation and getting people to start thinking about what the norms should be and then what the criminal law should be. Like you, I am very worried about adopting a criminal law that would lead to sort of widespread prosecutions of folks that may well be making innocent mistakes. But the real question, again, is why is it reasonable to think that somebody who hasn't said anything is consenting?
And I think the answer remains the same as it did before we went on this little loop, which is, yep, it is not reasonable.
Okay.
It is not okay, but I don't think you can criminalize it. And the reason I say that is because it is just the power of the state is so great. You are talking about a crime. If you walk up to somebody that you don't know and take their wallet, let's say you pick up a girl in a bar, right?
Okay.
And, you go home and you, have sex and it's consensual sex and you take her wallet, right? You just take it in your hand. Did she say, you can take my wallet? No. Is it a crime? Well, not unless you intend to steal it. So what does it depend on? It depends on your intent, right? It depends on the defendant's intent. It's not a crime to have picked up the wallet unless you are going to steal the wallet, unless you intend that. And it doesn't depend on her intent. The only way in which it depends on her intent is if she intended to give it to you. But if you just intended to pick the wallet up, but you didn't intend to take it, then it's not. So I would submit it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying about that question, about the analogy. But I guess what I want to get back to then is this basic question of intent, which you're emphasizing as being so important here. And of course, the law treats, we have a nuanced approach to definitions of intent. And in the context of rape and sexual assault, we don't require intent to rape. We require a proof of, again, the question would be, would a reasonable person in the position of these parties have been aware that they were proceeding in the absence of consent? And one of the reasons we don't require intent, I take it, is because the harm's been done. The person has had sex with someone who's not consenting. I guess what I want to go back to, though, is ask you, you've conceded that it is not reasonable or it's not appropriate for someone to proceed as we've described. So someone who, you're going to have sex with somebody who in no way, shape, or form has manifested that they're agreeable. You know, you just shouldn't proceed. And again, my position there, my students push me on this question all the time, is if you're facing that situation, just go ahead and ask. You know, if the person hasn't signaled in any way, shape, or form that they are agreeable, you know, just go ahead and ask. What's the harm in asking?
At this moment, we are going to take a break. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, and we'll be right back. So we're back on the air on Straight Talk with Ann Coughlin, and we are talking about sexual assault, and essentially, we're having a conversation about what the law ought to be, about what the law is and how it might benefit from some change. You and I seem to have a disagreement as to, in the category in which consent or non-consent is not expressed. What does that mean for the criminal law? But I would submit that our area of disagreement is a very narrow one, in that most of the time you have some expression of consent or non-consent in most sexual assaults. It may not be, yes, let's have sex now, but there's some communication that happens.
Yeah, I believe that that's right. And I mean, I'm sure that's right. And, that's one of the tricky things about this area generally is the way in which people go about having sex, or the way in which they decide, who their partners are going to be and when the time is right, and then how they're going to communicate this. This is not a case where we have detailed contracts, and it would be just preposterous, sort of laugh out loud funny, to suggest that we should. If the law were to do that, it would be flying in the face of social norms and potentially, as you keep reminding me, punishing people for violating, familiar ways of proceeding. And I guess that's one of the big and difficult questions here. Is the feminist movement trying to suggest that the criminal law should start punishing men for behaving the way in which men have ordinarily been behaving? And they think that it's safe to proceed. They've got the green light. The woman hasn't said no. It's perfectly fine for them to keep on going. So again, I guess one of the questions that I just want to toss right back to you again is this issue of whose perspective are you adopting here when you say that, it's really painful to contemplate locking people up for making this kind of a mistake. I worry that you're privileging a male perspective here, because from the perspective of the women, the many, many women that I've talked to and many women whose voices are being heard in this debate, is that from their perspective, it's quite the opposite, that it's beyond unreasonable for men to think that it's appropriate to proceed to have sex with them, in the absence of some sort of clear signals.
I would submit that the perspective I am privileging is that of an ordered liberty, and that under principles of the presumption of innocence and due process in this country, that when we're talking about the criminal law, we have to be slightly more circumspect than we might be in terms of what is appropriate or what is reasonable. People do things all the time that are inappropriate, but they're not criminalized. And we're not talking about a small criminal offense. We're not talking about a reckless driving ticket where you're going to get a fine. We're talking about locking somebody up for the rest of their lives. And so that's where I think our difference arises, is that I'm focusing on the procedural issue from that perspective, and you are looking more at the application of it and the experiences of women.
Yeah, I'm going to take issue with that. I don't think that I'm in any way, shape, or form flying in the face of the principles of ordered liberty. Quite the contrary. I am not suggesting, for example, that we should do away with burdens of proof. And I'm really not suggesting that we should, I'm certainly not suggesting that we should make, radical alterations in the requirements of mens rea and so forth. Again, what I'm asking is, why not adopt a substantive definition that is equally protective of women's experience of what counts as rape, what counts as assault? Why adopt a position that privileges the male perspective?
Well, don't you think when you say women, 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 we're talking about women as victims, right? If you have a situation in which two people have sex and they don't have a conversation, either one of them, about whether it's consensual or not, why is the woman the victim?
Now, that's a fabulous question, and it's one that I wrestle with all the time and discuss with my students and even write about. And so I would absolutely want to move towards a world where the sexual double standard was gone, where women aren't continued to be portrayed as stigmatized by sex, and then where men aren't portrayed as the ones who always want to have sex. So one of the examples that I give my students when we talk about intoxicated sex is if you walk into a bar and there's someone at the bar who's very, 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 very drunk, and that person says, hey, let's have sex, is it reasonable for you to think that you're getting good consent? And the student's reaction to the problem utterly depends on the sex or gender of the intoxicated person. If it's a female who's intoxicated, they really worry about whether this consent is genuine. If it's a male who's intoxicated, they have no worries whatsoever because men always want to have sex.
Because men aren't defiled.
Men aren't defiled. Men always want to have sex. And so what I say to them, wow, that's really sexist too. So it may well be that the sexual double standard that I'm identifying, and in fact I'm committed to this view, is in fact harmful to men. We see that in many, many places. Men are sexually assaulted, but they're afraid to come forward and report because they're not believed. Police officers will think, well, she's doing you a favor. And you'll even hear men tell those stories. So those are issues as well. I think it can be quite difficult to tell potentially who is victim and who is perpetrator, and that's another set of questions that I want to get into.
I think it might be very difficult to even begin to describe in a way that you could visualize a sexual encounter between two people in which neither one of them expresses any consent or non-consent, and yet they have sex. And so I guess I'm just sort of taking issue with the idea that, you know, that happens. I mean, I suppose you might not have a verbal expression of consent.
Oh, well, if they're both really intoxicated, you can have it. Because,
yeah, sure.
Because in the cases, I mean, and because that's the point, they're intoxicated, and I take it that their bodies are doing something that the viewer might construe as action that is meaningful. But the story after the fact would be, and this is the story we're hearing in cases, is that the complaining witness says, whoa, wait a minute, I was so drunk, I was incapacitated, I was incapable of consenting, so my physical gestures, whatever they may be, don't count.
Right.
And the perpetrator should have known that.
But who's the perpetrator?
Well, that's the question. If the perpetrator is also highly intoxicated, these cases can become excruciating and impossible to resolve. And at the end of the day, you're left with what I think is not entirely an academic question. Are they both victims? Were they both unable to consent because they were so drunk?
I would submit that this is the point where the theoretical conversation becomes a practical conversation. And in the world that I live in, if this happens, the guy is getting prosecuted. That's what happens. I have never seen a woman prosecuted for raping a man, and certainly not in the situation that we're talking about, which again I think is a very narrow situation where nobody expresses anything.
That's right, and I agree with what you're saying, and again that raises the question of whether it's a sexual double standard, or that in fact we should be thinking of women as perpetrators here. The fact of the matter remains, based on that old-style way of thinking that I've described, is that women are likely to feel stigmatized or injured or something by having had sex in this incapacitated situation where men are not. And men certainly don't step up and report, she raped me. But we are, because I was too drunk to consent, she mm-hmm. raped me. We are beginning to see those cases emerge in the military, though, because in the military we're having many more prosecutions than we did in the past, and just like those that happen in the rest of the world, they often involve highly intoxicated people, young, highly intoxicated people, and the question is, were they too incapacitated to consent? As you suggested, the defendant is invariably a male. But in some of the cases, the men are starting to step up and to say, hey, wait a minute, I was just as drunk as she was. This is even an equal protection violation. Now, the cases those arguments aren't going anywhere yet. But there, you know, there could come a time when we really have to confront the question.
It seems to me that from a practical standpoint, when you look at the theoretical issue of whether or not someone has to express consent or non-consent, the practical effect of a rule that says no, you don't have to express your non-consent for it to be a rape is that more men are going to go to prison. and the women are not going to go to prison for the same situation.
Why do you think that more men are going to go to prison? And again, I guess I take it. So you think more women are going to complain, or yeah, there are going to be more prosecutions?
I think that when those cases are tried, the men are not going to complain because of the cultural stigma,
right?
It's not okay to be a man and cry, let alone be a man and be raped, right? So they're not going to complain. The women are going to complain. And when it comes to the courts or the juries, our jurisprudence is steeped in hundreds of years of common law, and it is steeped in, ultimately, in the Bible. When you sort of trace it all the way back to some of its roots, I think it is, and that's not exactly a feminist document in a lot of ways. And I think that the result is going to be that judges and juries are going to convict the man in a situation where two people have sex and nothing is said. That's what's going to happen, and that's not an appropriate outcome. And so, therefore, I think you have to have some expression of non-consent before you can criminalize it. Is it okay? Is it a good idea to have sex with someone? No, it's a terrible idea. But I think to make it a crime, because that is going to be the practical effect, I think you should have to have some expression.
So how about changing the rules then and doing exactly what you say and define rape as a crime that occurs when one person has sex with another in the absence of affirmative permission?
That's even worse. Now you have to actually say yes. And we know that's not how human sexuality works. That isn't a solution at all. That goes one step in the wrong direction.
So I want to ask you why you're so confident that you know how human sexuality works. What are you basing this on? And again, you know, and I guess should the empirical provide the basis for the normative? You know, obviously through the law, we want to provide some aspirational ways of thinking. But I'm really curious to know why you're confident that you know how human sexuality works. And is it really the case that we don't expect people to look for affirmative permission, again, at least in some contexts? You know, the contexts that I'm having in mind are the ones where we tend to see the rape allegations most frequently on our campus and in the military as well, is where people aren't acquainted with each other. They don't have a course of conduct. They're not married. They're not intimate partners. They've never done this before. And what's wrong with a law that says, hey, wait a minute, if we're going to punish you if the partner didn't do something to suggest you can go forward?
Well, I'm not Susie Bright, so point well taken. I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert in human sexuality.
Yeah.
However, I'm a human who has sex.
Okay.
And I'm also a member of the culture. And we have, you know, I want you to think about every first kiss scene you've ever seen in a novel or a romantic movie. And I want you to picture now the place where the faces are coming closer together. It's that moment. We're going to have that first kiss between these two characters. And I want you to imagine that that is a sexual battery, because that is the result of what you're proposing. No one said, you may kiss me now. So you sexually battered them.
Yeah, but you're asking the wrong question. I'm not demanding a verbal yes. What I'm saying is that we want to be able to, the rules should be structured so that you're requiring some proof.
You are. You're demanding affirmative consent. That is.
But it's not a yes. It's not requiring a yes.
Well, tell me how that works.
It can be body language. It can be the way in which people proceed.
So now whether or not you're a criminal is going to depend on the interpretation of the look in someone's eyes when you leaned forward to kiss them. And that's how we're going to define it in the criminal law.
I think that that's probably the way non-consent gets defined today. I don't think it's that different from what you're asking for. I think the standard, and well, let me go back. You know, I pushed you there because I'm curious to see what you think about embedding that in the criminal law. I'm not sure what position that I take with respect to affirmative permission in the criminal law. That might be a step too far. I'm firmly of the view that a no means no standard.
And
I
agree. There's no difference between us on that point.
So I've got you on the record on that front.
If a person says no,
right,
that means no. Well, how hard do you have to get me on the record on that one? Who doesn't think that?
Well, oh, Lord. So let me give you the example.
Okay.
And this is the sexual battery case that I have in mind. So when I first came to UVA in 1995, 1996, mm-hmm, there was a case involving a man who was arrested for several alleged sexual batteries in the Barracks Road Mall.
Right.
And he ultimately was convicted for those crimes. And what obviously it's sexual battery, so it's not rape. It didn't involve intercourse.
So here basically with sexual battery, we're talking about a touching. Who touched your breast, but, you know,
exactly.
Some private part,
exactly.
Of you, not your shoulder, but something with a sexual context.
Exactly. And that's exactly what this guy did. But here was the setup. He would go into a shop, women's clothing shops in the Barracks Road Mall, and he would ask a saleswoman to model a purse. Say, he'd say, I want to buy this purse for my mom, or I want to buy this dress for my wife.
Right.
And will you hold the dress up just against your shoulder so I can see what it looks like, or hold the purse? And
sure.
So the saleswoman would do that, and then he would come over and he would fondle her breast. He would grab her by the breast through the fabric or through the purse or something like that. So he's arrested for sexual battery, and it turns out that he can't be prosecuted for sexual battery because there was no force, threat, or intimidation.
Are you serious? Is this a Virginia case?
I am absolutely serious. I will give you the story from the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
What about Roos?
That was when Roos was added to the statute.
Okay, so
the
now
man,
that would not happen.
Correct, but why does there have to be a Roos? Why do you have to prove a Roos? I mean, the victims in those cases, so it goes to show you force, threat, intimidation does some work. Why not just make the sexual touching? And we'd have to have some definition. What parts of the body? Is it your crotch? Is it your...
Right.
Your breast? Is it your butt? And so forth. But the women were, again, at the time, outraged, the
VIX.
And the legislature, instead of saying, oh, a sexual battery occurs when there is a non-consensual. And notice here, you don't have to express anything.
Right.
Right. So that's why I want to go back to
that. Well, that, I think, is the better point of your argument.
I know.
You don't have to say
anything.
But
that's my point.
Right.
Why didn't they simply say, yo, wait a minute, force, threat, or intimidation, we don't, why would we require that? Why do we require that showing in these cases? So they get him for simple battery. Let's be clear. He is prosecuted. It is a non-consensual touching. But it's
what case is that? I got to look this up.
I'm sorry. I have the story. I've got the...
It's printed out.
I've got the Richmond Times-Dispatch story printed out.
I'll just ask you for it later. So this is, again, that moment where I'm supposed to say, you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk, and my guest today is Ann Coughlin, who's a professor of law at the University of Virginia.
Go ahead. I'm so eager. We only have a couple of minutes.
I just have to say those things.
So that's where we should have started, then. If you agree, whoa, it's a no-brainer that counts, you know, as some kind of a sexual crime, you don't need force, threat, intimidation, and you don't need ruse. It counts. No.
When I said no means no, what I said was, if you say no, you may not do this.
Correct.
Then that means no.
Okay.
But I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is, in this situation, no one would think that it was okay to grab this person's breast. Okay, you know, I understand that. And so, to a certain extent, what you're saying is, well, that absolute rule, you know, can't apply in every situation. Okay, but I would think by the time you're having sex with somebody, we're not talking about an incidental touching. We're not talking about, I touched your breast. We're talking about, we are now having intercourse. There would have been an expression of some kind, unless you're talking about someone who's essentially rendered unconscious by being so drunk.
I guess I really want to push back hard against that. So my students tell me they go out...
I would expect nothing less.
Yeah, they go out at night and they go to a bar, for example, and people come up and grab them by the breasts. And people come up and grab them by the butts. And they're confused. They say to me, is this some kind of misconduct? Is this some kind of a crime? And I say, absolutely, yes, it is. So there's confusion there. So again, you got to take it out of Barracks Road. You've got to take this kind of sexual touching out of Barracks Road and put it in the places that we're talking about, the places where people have initial contact that leads up to having sex. So there's confusion there. But then, too, I guess I want to ask you why you're so confident that there would be a yes along the way, and or some expression along the way, or no. And the question, again, goes back to whose perspective are you using to determine whether there's a yes or a no? And why is it that you would think that if I've agreed to kiss you, or I've agreed to pat you on the butt, or I've done these things, that there's that it's okay to go ahead and all the way and have sex?
I guess what I'm saying is, if you're going to convict someone of a crime, then it has to be communicated to the person one way or the other. You cannot say whether or not this is a crime depends on someone else's mental state. It has to depend on that person's mental state. I would submit that that person who is in Barracks Road putting this dress up to this person intends to do something to that person that they don't want. Right, they intend to do that. Whereas when you have a situation where two people are having sex and there's no communication about it, that you can't say that person intends to rape that person. You have to have some, you have to have something that depends on the mental state of the actor, of the criminal defendant.
Correct. But you keep using the word intent, and I realize that I'm being pushy here in a way that may seem like hair splitting, but it's not. And it's, there's proof of intent is not required in the sense that he knows or intends, but would a reasonable person believe that the other person was consenting, and that's what's required? And so the question becomes, whose perspective do we use to decide what kinds of cues are signals you can go forward and penetrate me or do whatever the ultimate sex act is that is occurring here?
And I would submit the answer is not the man's perspective or the woman's perspective, but the criminal defendant's perspective.
Wait, I'm not sure. So you want the criminal defendant's perspective to govern?
Yes.
Reasonable?
No, I want there to be an intention to do something that is criminal.
Okay, so then the problem for you, I take it, becomes that you really want to revise the penal code much more broadly.
Are we sitting here talking about revising the penal code because you want to change the law as well?
Well, I do. I mean, so what I want to know is that your position then? Do you think that there shouldn't be punishment in cases, in homicide cases, in other kinds of cases, unless there is what you're calling intent?
You can't have a murder without an intent to commit a crime.
Well, sure you can. You can have second-degree murder. Second-degree murder is based on a definition of malice that has nothing to do with purpose to commit a crime.
Malice is a messed-up idea.
Well, I know that. I mean, when we had the Yardley Love murder, which was so tragic, I delved deeply into what you law that you know well. So again, I just want to be clear with you. We punish based on a malice definition. That's a negligence definition. It's sometimes even a strict liability definition.
I don't think we should have a strict liability standard for rape.
I don't either. But the question becomes, why not have the malice negligence definition?
Tell me what you mean by malice. Because most people, when they think of malice, most people who are not lawyers who are just listening, they think, you know, an intention to hurt somebody, bad feeling, an intent issue. But that's not really what malice means.
No.
Malice, in the context you're talking about, means premeditation.
No, as I spend a lot of time with my students, malice coming out of the common law means everything from premeditation through strict liability, because we punish as malicious felony murders, which includes strict liability. And again, the point for the listeners
here, malice in terms of second-degree murder essentially comes down to premeditation. The reason that second-degree murder is potentially different.
No, extreme indifference to the value of human life is included there. That's got nothing to do with purpose to kill. Second-degree murder also includes felony murders. I mean, so that was another theory on which they were prosecuting George Hughley. So again, what I'm trying to ask you is this question is, why are you so insistent that in the context of rape, you want something that looks like intent or purpose when we don't require that elsewhere? Why are we not being unfair to defendants elsewhere? Or I guess what I want to ask you is, are you not advocating a double standard for rape cases?
No, I'm advocating an intent standard.
Okay.
I think you have to have an intent, and the intent cannot reside in someone else's head. As a practical matter, what ends up happening is people go to bars, they both get drunk, they go home, they have sex, and then someone changes their mind later and says, I was raped. And then we say, oh, well, there wasn't affirmative consent.
Yeah,
well,
it really disheartens me to hear you say that. That's very, very hurtful from the perspective of a feminist. Suddenly what you're suggesting is the regret after the fact that a woman wakes up in the morning and says, gosh, I really wish.
Or a man. How about a man?
They're not doing it. We said that before.
No, they're not. They're not, which is why it's a problem, which is why I say we are talking about the defendant's perspective. We are not talking about a male perspective or a female perspective. I'm talking about, in the abstract, what do you want to have in the law?
I don't want a law that makes it that judges the legality of behavior from the perspective of the individual defendant. I want a criminal law that insists that we hold criminal defendants to community norms. So I think, and I'm not sure that you would impose the most serious punishment on someone who is merely unreasonable in these cases.
Well, maybe if we were talking about differentiating from a rape.
And I am talking about that. I mean, so we haven't gotten into the complexity of the proposed solution. I'm not saying that the people who are unreasonable are as serious as the people who are intending to do harm.
I'm relieved to hear you say that.
But I want to go back. But the criminal law has done that all along. That was my point to you. We punish as murder people who are behaving without any intent to kill in the felony murder arena, for example, and we are. So, but again, I guess I really have to go back and say that it's very disheartening to hear you say that you think that what's happening in these cases is that women are waking up after the fact and regretting and suddenly claiming rape. That is not at all the empirical world that I know. The empirical world that I know is women don't report because they think they're not going to be believed because they're working with law enforcement and prosecutors that say, we think women make false claims. So this notion that someone wakes up the next morning and regrets after the fact, I think that's something that we've really, really got to fight against.
And I think it happens. I don't think it happens every time. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying it does happen. And in the criminal law, we should be protecting people from a wrongful conviction more than we should be trying to make sure that people who are guilty are convicted. It is more important that an innocent person not be convicted than that every guilty person be convicted. And that's the perspective from which I'm coming.
I get that. And I realize that that's a very appealing and a very attractive high ground. The problem is that what we have done through the sexism in the culture and in the criminal law more generally is that we have disbelieved the word of women. We have refused to believe that they're telling the truth. We've refused to credit their no unless they can point to something forceful, unless they can point to injuries on their body.
What do you think would happen if a man came in and said these things? Do we think we would disbelieve his word or no? We'd go, oh, that woman raped him. What do you think we'd do?
You know, again, I think that you're identifying a really serious problem. I think we disbelieve him, and I think that that's utterly tragic.
I think he'd be laughed out of court.
He would be laughed out of court, and I guess what I want to know is, do you think that that's a good result?
No, I don't. I think it's a terrible result.
Well, then good. Then it just proves my point that we want to have a standard that accepts what, at least at face value originally, what victims might be saying, and then investigates further. That is the tragedy. I mean, we're seeing that in a lot of cases. Men are afraid to step up.
Agreed. We have just a few minutes left. Is there anything else you want to sort of cover that we haven't got to? I mean, I know there are probably a million things to cover.
Yeah. The one thing that I did want to mention is that I know you're going to have a Title IX guest on later, and I just hope that if listeners have the opportunity to hear her show, I urge you to listen to her show because it's a really fascinating set of questions.
That's going to be Palma Pastilnik, and it's going to be 2 weeks from today. She's going to be on here talking about sexual misconduct at universities, which is what Title IX is.
Correct. And so one of the things that I wanted to say about this hour that I was really pleased about is that here in Charlottesville, of course, we've been heavily focused on the campus issues, as we should be. And the Rolling Stone story, the very tragic murders of Hannah Graham and Morgan Harrington. You know, we've been focused on the safety on campuses, but the problems go well beyond the boundaries of the grounds of the University of Virginia. We're talking about the safety and security of people everywhere in the Commonwealth. And we're also talking about the criminal law rules that govern men everywhere, not just men on our campuses. Again, I realize I'm using the word men as if man is always the perp, woman is always the victim. Empirically, that's the case. So I really want us to be mindful of the need to reform the law in ways that's not just focused on our campus.
Okay. Well, Ann, I have really, really enjoyed our conversation. I've enjoyed meeting you. I think you're
thank you
you're
so much for having
thing.
Me. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being on.
It's and, good to be
maybe,
here.
Maybe we'll talk again sometime.
Good. Thanks.
All right. This is Andre Hanks. I'm signing out for Straight Talk, and we'll see you next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.